Nowadays, information technology is an essential part of any nation-state toolkit. And yet, in the digital space, nation-states are just a few of many actors. A mastery of cyber operations can give nation-states the advantage they need to pursue their economic, national security, or foreign policy goals. But without private sector and civil society cooperation, that mastery is difficult to achieve. Hosted by the Atlantic Council Cyber Statecraft Initiative, Season 1 of Digital Statecraft, Digital Statecraft features diverse perspectives from thinkers in academia, industry, and government. By bridging the worlds of statecraft and of streetcraft, it examines questions at the nexus of information and communication technologies, geopolitics, and national security, searching for cooperation to make cyberspace safer, more stable, and more secure for all.
Hi, I'm Beau Woods, Cyber Safety Innovation Fellow at the Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security, and host of today's conversation, Supply Chain Security in the 21st Century. Today's episode is underwritten by Raytheon, and my guest is John Check, Senior Director, Cyber Protection Solutions, Cybersecurity and Special Missions for Raytheon Intelligence, Information, and Services. John, welcome.
Thanks, Beau. I'm delighted to be here.
So, John, you've got a very long title, a very impressive organization. Tell us a little bit about what you do on your day-to-day job and why you're perfect for this conversation.
All right. Well, first I'll start. That's why we have a lot of acronyms within the defense industrial base was based on the title you just went through. My focus as leading the cyber protection solutions team at Raytheon is really around defensive cyber. That covers everything from assessments to red teams, incident response, threat hunting, SOC services, just a whole variety. Anything that's defensive in nature, my team does that. And across our customer base, which includes federal, state, and local, as well as commercial companies. We have quite a few commercial companies as customers as well, which probably surprise people.
Well, you certainly bring a broad base of experience to the conversation. I know we were talking earlier, and you've been in this field for many, many years working on IT systems, IT solutions. So we just had a conversation on supply chain at the Atlantic Council. Without rehashing it, I think to frame today's conversation on the podcast, I want to throw out a helpful framework to kind of get our minds wrapped around supply chain security. So there's four essential ways that supply chain security issues can manifest. The first one to talk about is operational phase supply chain security. This is once your organization is already up and running, once you've installed all the equipment and you're operating in your environment. You have contractors, you have others, you have suppliers who come in, you have third parties who connect to your network. The second type then is counterfeit. This is usually not a malicious act. It's, it could be in the defense industrial base, an organization who needs chips that are out of production and have been out of production for 20, 30 years, or it could be suppliers trying to shave pennies on the chips that they supply. Then a third type is malicious taint. Now, these are deliberate implants. This is the type of thing that we usually associate with nation-state level actors who infiltrate the supply chain and put deliberately tainted components into equipment that goes out to customers. And then the fourth and final type is unintended taint. These are inadvertent holes or flaws that come from configuration vulnerabilities or what's called known but unmitigated vulnerabilities. In Executive Order 13800. And these are typically not implanted. They are simply discovered and revealed in the natural course of finding issues. And it allows potentially anyone who can download a tool from the internet to be able to take advantage of them. But of course, supply chain is much bigger than just technology. As we talked about, there's a defense industrial base. There's what's starting to be called a national industrial base. And issues with that could include, who owns these firms, who manufactures their supplies. So how deep does that supply chain go? Who are their partners and allies? Who are they letting into their environment? Who are their customers? Who supplies their infrastructure? So there's a whole broad conversation that's been going on in supply chain security over the past 10 plus years, really looking back at what can be done. It's traditionally not been super sexy. But in the last couple of years, it's really kind of blossomed and flourished. So, John, what to you are some of the maybe unconventional or surprising supply chain issues that you're seeing?
Well, I guess we definitely, across our customers, we see all aspects of it. So I'll focus on the commercial customers in the sense of we have financial, telecom, as well as energy-related customers, medical customers. And really, the challenges they face are very similar in the sense of a lot of them don't recognize the full scope of the problems or of the threats that they're facing. They believe that they have their teams. They're very smart people doing great things, but nobody can cover the waterfront from their own point of view. And that's one of the biggest risks, is just that awareness of what are all those challenges that could come my way. I've seen some very interesting things. With the Shadowhammer attack with ASUS, the latest information that I've saw was really when the people have dug into that, they're really targeting about 600 MAC addresses. Just so happened it was downloaded by a million. But the attack was very focused, which covered a broad swath of people being infected. But the majority of those people never would have had any ill consequences from that, because it was a very targeted attack to a certain degree. I think that's when people, this is one of the surprising things, is you hear about a lot of these things with supply chain or other cyber incidents, and people hear some of the things that have happened, but they're never really affected. So they just go on about their business and say, well, that really didn't affect me. I heard about it. Sounded like it affected a lot of people, but I never had any things that affected my business or my personal way of life or my supply chain.
Yeah. So it's like if it's not made personal to the organization or the human who's sitting behind that organization, they can't really internalize it.
Right.
What are some of the things that organizations can do to actually get ahead of some of the supply chain threats, some of the supply chain risks in their own organization, whether, you know, federal government, whether private sector or others?
So when it comes to risk management and defining how your organization is going to approach that, assessments are critical. And when it comes to assessments, do you do the work yourself or do you hire somebody to do it? The make versus buy is critical when addressing any cybersecurity challenge, especially within organizations that may be medium to smaller businesses. A lot of organizations try to hire the cybersecurity experts and get into the cyber talent arms race, which no one can win. You can't out-hire the cyber threat. And so organizations need to recognize that there are providers they can buy those solutions from on an as-a-service basis, consume what they need, and then turn it off. They don't need to worry about having a cyber person on their staff that they may or may not be able to keep up with the economics of giving them continuous opportunities to grow their skills before they leave to go somewhere else.
Yeah, that's really interesting, tying it to the cybersecurity skills gap, which I think I saw somebody last year said it's now 3.5 million people, which I just can't believe. That's like greater than 1% of the total workforce in the United States. We need to fulfill these cybersecurity jobs. Like, it just doesn't seem reasonable. You're right. If it's an arms race, we're going to lose that race.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, one of the keys to do that. One of the keys for supply chain is really embracing machine learning, robotic process automation, and those things that we can do, those rote tasks that are very predictable, repeatable, is to automate those. So knowing that we are never going to be able to hire 3 million people in the timeline we'd like to, we're in definitely a cyber workforce bubble. Don't know how long it's going to last. At some point it will burst, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. And one of the things that we can do to mitigate that, other than, you know, some of the stuff we're doing around education, retooling, retraining, reskilling workforce of people, turning them into cyber professionals, is really that ruthless automation, knowing that we won't be able to have the people we need to fill the jobs, and really driving that machine learning and robotic process automation towards those problems.
Yeah. And it also starts with, you know, if you're eliminating problem space, you have to have fewer people to fill the problem space, right? So
that's right.
If you can cut out the need for some of the cybersecurity jobs, it's easier to fill the remaining actual gaps. And I think that's a place where supply chain comes in really handy. Kevin McDonald of the Mayo Clinic sometimes says something like, a medical device is just another crappy computer on my network that I can't defend.
Right.
And with the Mayo Clinic, they've got all the buying power in the world, and they still can't buy things, medical devices and other things that are secure. So maybe talk about the role of buying Internet of Things devices and talking with manufacturers who traditionally haven't had to worry about cybersecurity because they haven't had any software code or connectivity, and now they're starting to come online.
It gets back to the make versus buy. I think a lot of them, what we've experienced is start off with, I'm going to hire people to fix my problem. And then they get down the path and have either bought point solutions and hired individuals and the solutions go stagnant over time. They're not maintained based on the changing marketplace within the cyber field, which is rapidly innovating. $7 billion a year last year alone, just from venture capitalists around cybersecurity solutions, services, et cetera. And that's just the venture. That doesn't include all the rest of industry that's innovating in that area. So the pace of change just doesn't allow people to keep up with that. You know, what? How should I secure my device? What device should I buy? And that's where having more of a consumption-based model where you're desiring an outcome versus trying to build it yourself. And that's what we really drive towards, is helping our customers realize that there is a different path. And I've got an analogy that I would use in this regard. It's kind of like right now we're in a place where everybody feels like they need to have their own cyber, their own tools, their own teams. I'll be very secretive. Maybe I will or won't share the vulnerabilities or the breaches that have happened to me. I don't want the embarrassment, loss of shareholder value, the things that might come along with recognizing that you've had a breach. But I kind of think of it as if you have a Thanksgiving dinner and everybody shows up with their own turkey, right? You know, you have one turkey for Thanksgiving. Everybody doesn't show up with their own turkey. You know, if you're going to show up, you ask the host, what should I bring? And you have a collaborative approach. Everybody brings what they can to make the feast happen. It's not everybody brings the one thing that's the centerpiece. And I think that's what gets lost a lot of times with where the market's going. And one thing that drives the workforce challenge we have is everybody feels like they need to do it on their own. It's not a lot of the collaboration. There's starting to be more. Great to see some of the stuff around the public-private collaboration that's happening and recognition that it needs to happen more. But we definitely need to build on that because it takes all of us to be able to build that feast that's going to help us win this.
We've talked a little bit about how change happens in an organization. And you know, there's generally talked about two types, bottom-up and top-down. I wonder if you've got any thoughts on what you've seen successful change look like for supply chain security.
So successful supply chain security really starts with the incentivization of the suppliers you have. And that's really ensuring that those suppliers understand exactly the type of information that you have as the person that receives their supply and what are the challenges you're facing. So they understand what your business problems are, what your challenges are. So they have a point of reference as to why you're asking them to do things a certain way to ensure that they're receiving their supplies from trusted sources and what that means to you and why that is it makes a critical difference when the end product or close to end product is delivered to a customer. So it's really that awareness early on in every part of the supply chain that really clearly understands why you're asking something. I think one of the clear change management challenges that I've always seen, unrelated to supply chain or cyber, is you have to back that change up as far as you can in the process to make everybody part of the change right when you start. Because when you try to force change after things have already happened, it's costly. People don't understand. They weren't informed. I'm not going to help you because I wasn't part of helping making the decision as to why we should change. I don't think we should change in the first place. And it really builds that point of reference. So anything we can do to really push the supply chain challenges and risks and awareness upstream is really going to make huge benefits to us in the long run.
Speaking about change, I want to keep drilling in on that because I think, you know, in a lot of cases, we may not know everything that's the best thing in the world to do, but we at least know what to avoid because we know that it fails. And despite all the good information that's published, all of the things that people tend to know to do or say they know to do, things just don't get done. So, you know, if you're looking at a sector level or at a national level, what are some of the ways that we could make change and bake in change into the supply chain across entire industry sectors or across the entire nation to protect our national economic security?
I think at some point we have to really get to a standards and certifications for different parts of the supply chain. So identifying those critical supplies and components that make up the core part of what we need to drive as a nation that supports our defense, really identifying what those are, those critical areas. We have critical infrastructure, but I don't think we've really taken it to the next step of what are those critical supplies that cut across as foundational elements of all the 16 critical infrastructure sectors. That's the point that I think we really need to focus on is really try to identify those critical aspects that are foundational across everything we do and maybe tack the problem a little differently from maybe take more of a horizontal approach to that versus the vertical. Here's the sectors and they're all different, even though they all consume a lot of the same underlying things to run their businesses.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, if you look around the critical infrastructure sectors, a lot of them are buying from the same manufacturers, from the same vendors, from the same operational suppliers, you know, the same business process outsourcers. And so there's a little bit maybe of a fallacy that each critical infrastructure sector has its own unique supply chain. They all share a supply chain. And if you get a level deeper, you know, it's not just the suppliers or the equipment, it's the individual software and hardware components, right? So there's what I think three chip manufacturers for big chips, Intel, ARM, and AMD. You've got, depending on who you ask and what sector you're in and what type of equipment, something like 60 to 80% of software code is open source or derived from open source. And a lot of that collapses around the same components. When you're driving down below the layer of what does critical infrastructure mean and what are the sectors, there's actually a lot to unpack there. And I think that that's unexplored ground.
So I think a lot of companies like Red Hat, who's really big in the open source arena, clearly past 25 years, it's really been addressing that, you know, Kubernetes and things of those nature. It's really trying to drive in that security so that software knows you're coming from a trusted source. And it has been a little bit, it's not going to say validated, but there is some root of trust being established for some of those building blocks or those containers that are building into these larger software solutions. So it's definitely recognized by the open source community. And it's one of those areas that you just continue to need a lot of focus, because it's very easy along the way to have something injected into your code in an open source environment that you might not realize if the person that's doing the development, their toolbox is their laptop, they might not have gotten downloaded the latest open source related to that specific container, and we're using something that's old with a known vulnerability unknown to them, because that's what they have on their machine. They're used to using it. That's the easy button. They're not going to go out and update and make sure they're using the latest.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a project underway right now with NTIA where they're looking at software transparency and what's called a software bill of materials to be able to track individual components so that you know that it's trustworthy and trusted. You know, some of them will be trustworthy, trusted. They'll be on the latest versions, and that's great. Some proportion of them will be older versions, which may or may not have security issues. Some of them will be just unknown code. It was maybe developed internally, maybe developed by a third-party firm. But to really help throughout the supply chain to be able to pass on that knowledge, because at the end of the day, every buyer is also a supplier to someone else until you get down to an individual human who's a consumer. So I think there's a lot to be done in that area.
Without a doubt. And I think a lot of that will come down to some of the controls, some of the very effective DevOps companies. Netflix, for example, great automation to get their tools, get their service out there, fail fast, multiple updates, continuously improving their solution, continuously through automated means, ensuring that it delivers what they're expecting it to deliver. And there's a lot to be learned there, because without automation, you're not going to be able to do it at the scale we need to ensure that you're doing things in a trusted manner. If we're leaving it up to individuals to do that, we will never be able to get there based on the proliferation of software solutions, apps, codes, et cetera.
Yeah. And you talked about the DevSecOps, which combines DevOps with security. And one of the things that I've seen is that companies start doing DevOps for economic reasons, because it's a lot of times cheaper, more streamlined. They could be more agile in delivering to their customers. But when they start talking about security, it's a big question mark. So what for you or for some of your the people that you work with has been that conceptual leap to go from DevOps to DevSecOps?
You hit on it exactly, which is people start off with DevOps with the hope of, I want to get my tools I need faster into the hands of the people that need them, whether it's somebody paying for a service or whether it's somebody that's performing mission from a government perspective. And very quickly, they realize the quality needs to follow on. And that quality, the quality aspect is it cyber hardened? That's part of the quality. Is it going to meet the role based on the austere environment that is being operated in? So very quickly, the immediate benefits of I'm getting tools into the hands of people that need them faster. And once people take that initial first step, they realize they very need to follow on with ensuring there's a high level of quality to ensure that when things are delivered, they are working the way they need to and hardened in the way they need to be.
I've had a lot of conversations. I served for a year with FDA as an entrepreneur in residence. We had a lot of conversations about the overlap between quality and security and how much of security is just an emergent property from quality. And I think that, you know, as you look to the government broadly and some of the efforts that are underway with U.S. Digital Services, Defense Digital Services, and other places to try and bring some of those automated, consistent, reliable processes into government, I think there's possibility for a sea change in the way that government itself not just develops, but protects itself. And I know that you have, like you said, a lot of government clients. So have you seen a huge difference between the private sector commercial clients and the government clients that you work with when it comes to adopting those types of technologies?
So I would say there's the only consistent part of that is everybody has a different level of maturity. And that's the same no matter what sector we're approaching within the commercial world. Certain businesses are more mature than others. And the business world's very dynamic based on mergers, acquisitions, and other things. People may acquire companies during the M&A process, may not have been able to do all the due diligence or understood some of the underlying problems or challenges there may have been in their cybersecurity posture. And those things bubble up years later as being problems. And it's the company that purchased the company that ends up looking like they didn't, that they had the breach when maybe it was a property they acquired. And within government, it's the same thing. There's certain, you know, within agencies, different components or bureaus within an agency are of all different levels of maturity based on funding, organizational maturity, what their core mission is. So it really varies. I wouldn't say that it really, it's a universal problem. And it's all about the maturity of that specific business and where their focus has been and whether or not it's been highlighted as a problem to them that they can afford to put their money against versus what their core mission is.
After all of this discussion that we've had today and over the past several months and years on supply chain issues, what are some of the public policy options for improving the security of supply chain?
So it's a number one thing that needs to be addressed is really how do you incentivize the supply chain to reach the outcomes that the government desires. Without that, setting an unfunded mandate or something along the lines that really won't drive people to action, you have to incentivize supply chain to action. Commercial markets are much larger than the government market. Granted, the government is a large buyer of services, but the commercial market at large is much larger and has the buying power. So really impacting that on a national level require that it really, it's a desired outcome to be a trusted supplier to where it will benefit them in their commercial space as well and not just be an additional cost to do business.
All right, lightning round. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. What is the most overhyped supply chain issue?
The most overhyped is AI, artificial intelligence by far. Machine learning is something that's done with code. AI is still something done with a PowerPoint.
Huh. Interesting. All right. What's the most underappreciated aspect of supply chain security?
The people that are performing the job every day, the buyers, the procurement folks, they're the ones that are really doing the heavy lifting. And we need to make sure that we're taking care of them and they understand what their role is in this. They're underappreciated.
All right. And then what's your takeaway? What do you want people to walk away from after listening to this conversation?
That this is serious work. It's a hard problem, but we're working to fix it. We're fully committed. I mean, we all recognize what the challenges are, but it takes, we're starting at the beginning stages with awareness, and there's a long road ahead to solve the problem.
Well, thank you very much, John, and thank you for listening to this episode of Digital Statecraft, Digital Streetcraft, Supply Chain Security in the 21st Century, brought to you by Raytheon and the Atlantic Council. I'm Beau Woods. If you enjoyed this podcast, please join us again soon.